Hello, and welcome to the CGD podcast. I'm Megan O'Donnell. I'm Assistant Director for Gender and a Senior Policy Analyst here at CGD. I am delighted today to be speaking with Agnes Kisumbing, who is a Senior Research Fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute, or IFPRI, as well as Dominique van de Waal, who is a visiting fellow here at CGD. Today, the three of us are going to be discussing the concept of household headship, what the term means, why it matters, and how it may be problematic. So first, to kick us off, I'm going to turn to Dominique to ask what we mean when we say headship.
Thanks, Megan. I'd say that at one level, headship was just a way of organizing the data collection at the household level in household level surveys. Yeah, and so this is just something people use in terms of an anchor that you can relate all other household members to basically describe the household. That has been something that was adopted across household surveys across the world, but researchers have used it often to compare households and to by headship. You know, say for example, in the context we're discussing, to compare female-headed with male-headed households. The head, in that sense, then the head means something a little more, and some people argue that it's not very meaningful. It was really just this anchor. But other people, including me, would argue that in certain contexts, there is a head of the household that basically makes a lot of decisions about resource allocation, about not necessarily all decisions, but does make decisions, and so it is meaningful. This is certainly not true in all countries and settings.
Agnes, I want to get your perspective on that last point. Under what circumstances would you say that headship is a useful category for analysis and programming, and under which circumstances is it maybe less useful?
So I want to start with the less useful part and then segue into the more useful part. So what I don't like is when headship is used as a proxy for all gender differences. I think it shows that the person doing the analysis is being lazy. The reason why I don't like it as a proxy for gender differences is that it doesn't address the situation of women in male-headed households who are still the majority of households worldwide. It's not a good proxy for gender differences within the household, which may vary by age and sex. And it doesn't capture the gender dynamics that's of decision-making within the household. So I think of headship as a very rough way to look at gender differences and gender dynamics. But I think it can be a useful concept when you know what it means in a particular context. So if you understand, for example, the processes that underlie headship, when you understand in particular societies what makes women become heads of households. So the context that I'm most familiar with is Bangladesh, where I've done a lot of field work. And there are really clear differences among women who head households, depending on how they became female heads. So for example, a woman who is widowed is usually in very dire straits. She may have to be living with her adult son to support her. A woman who's divorced maybe in dire straits as well. But a woman whose husband is temporarily absent because he's migrating and making remittances might be in pretty good shape. In Dominique's case, I think her work in Africa shows that a lot of women who are widowed are really quite vulnerable to falling further into poverty or worse outcomes. So I think you have to understand the context of the society where a woman becomes female-headed to see whether it's a useful category for identifying people that you reach for, say, poverty reduction programs mm-hmm. or social protection. Mm-hmm.
And do you feel that traditionally that sort of granularity, that context-specific understanding has been lacking? In other words, do you think that headship has been relied on too much as a marker of gender differences?
I think in some contexts, yes. So again, looking at the situation of Bangladesh, where you have a lot of migration, if you were going to use headship only as a way to target social protection programs, you would probably be missing a lot.
That makes sense. Dominique, Agnes just mentioned work that you've done in the past on widows within the context of Africa. Would you say that headship is a useful lens on household poverty in Africa? Can you talk a bit about that work?
Yes, and first let me say that I completely agree with what Agnes has said, and the work in Bangladesh, I think, echoes a lot of what I found in Africa. So first, I think it's important to realize that female-headed households account for almost a quarter of all African households and about a fifth of the continent's population. So, and these shares have been growing in the last three decades. So they now represent a large group of households that will be even larger in the future. So I'd argue that household organization matters for welfare in the Africa context, in particular for intra-household inequality and hence individual poverty, and that headship is really one aspect of this. You know, social, economic, and legal norms in Africa have very much evolved over, you know, historical periods, long time, around the old status quo of the African household type as one headed by a married male head. That really is the culturally expected, the most common type of household. So female-headed households are really out of this cultural norm, and they're the result of unusual situations, and most often that is a marital dissolution, such as in Bangladesh, so widowhood and divorce, which are not always, but often very correlated, highly correlated with poverty. And the social and economic legal norms have not adapted to this increasing importance of female-headed households. And so again, as Agnes mentioned, the ability of female-headed households to flourish in what are still very gender unequal societies, Bangladesh and Africa, many places in Africa, depends critically on why they are female-headed and will often be difficult.
And would you say, you know, among African female-headed households, there are particular types that tend to be more disadvantaged?
Yeah, again, this is going to vary a lot according to context and individual cases, but I'd identify two particularly vulnerable groups. And first, the one that we've most been talking about, those headed by women who have lost a husband through death or divorce. And the widows and divorcees head some 64% of all African female-headed households, and more of those are widowed, 46%. And most are still married under customary law in Africa, and this, you know, the context here is that marriage is still very much the basis for production and women's access to land, for example, and social and economic rights. Women don't really have individual rights except through their father and then their husband. And then, of course, those rights are totally conditional on marriage, and so they're lost at divorce or widowhood, which can be devastating for a lot of households. You know, family property, houses and land, is typically passed on through men. There's a number of studies that show that widows, under customary law, which is applies to most women, widows often inherit nothing at all and are completely dispossessed and thrown out and ostracized in society. And that's true also at divorce. You know, recent research also shows that African widows and divorcees can face at the individual level very severe hardship, and that disadvantage spills over to their children. Again, it's not universal. There are some widow-headed households that choose, women that choose not to remarry, and that because they have a house, because they have a job, they have resources, they can allow, you know, they can afford not to get remarried. But then there are others who don't get remarried because they cannot. They're not able to, but they would be much, much better off had they. The other group that I think is very vulnerable are female-headed households that don't have, you know, have few labor units and specifically no male adults. So many female-headed households will have, like in Bangladesh, maybe, you know, adult sons or sons that are sort of 16, 17, 18 years old and are still there, and through which they can access a lot of the male-dominated markets, particularly in rural areas, such as, you know, credit markets and land rental markets and so on, that are much, it's much harder for women to do without a man. So I think, yeah, let me stop there.
So what Dominique just spoke to, I think, really reflects the nuance. And some of the differences between female-headed households headed by widows or divorced women, as she mentioned, also increased vulnerability among women who don't have that male adult counterpart living with them. In light of those nuances and those details, Agnes, what do you think we should be doing differently in terms of data collection and the research and analysis around headship?
So I would probably suggest that we move towards seeing headship as useful in the data collection sense. I think this is what people find useful just as an organizing principle, but not to believe in it completely. So, for example, in my experience in doing household surveys that look at women's empowerment, we interview a primary male and a primary female adult. They're usually married or in union with each other because we're looking at spousal decision-making. So in that context, headship was not the organizing principle that we used because it wasn't relevant for what we were looking at. In other contexts, we focus on the primary caregiver, the index child. This is in the case of nutrition interventions, and we would look at her partner. So this is not to say that if you're running a really large household survey like the DHS, that these organizing principles are not useful. I think they are useful. I think what is dangerous is when people get lazy analytically and don't unpack what headship means or don't use other characteristics of individuals and of households to guide their analysis.
Well, to translate that into a conversation, you know, focused on CGD, we certainly don't want to be lazy analytically here. We want to make sure that all of the evaluations that we're running, all of the policy proposals that we're putting forth are rooted in the most accurate, comprehensive data, right, on who needs to be targeted and who needs to be sort of prioritized in making sure we work to eradicate poverty and improve well-being. So to both of you, Dominique, to start with you, how would you translate this conversation about more nuance in our understanding of headship and data into a policy recommendation that should be founded on that data?
There's so many things one could do, but let me focus on, in the Africa context again, property rights are absolutely key. And there, I think we need to be careful because there have been a lot of policies trying to, you know, give titles to women on land and so on, and lots of RCTs showing, you know, that works and so on. But what hasn't really been asked, you know, so if you look at surveys, you find that women, you know, often are joint owners of the land or whatever with the husband and head of household. What isn't clear to me is what happens if they're widowed. Is that land go back to the lineage or the household, you know? Does the woman actually keep it? And I think in most cases, she probably doesn't really own it she doesn't inherit it at all. So I think those, understanding that better and, you know, developing property rights that actually deal with cases of divorce and widowhood is very important. I'd also mention very simple things like marriage contracts. So many of these women never have a contract. They're married under customary law, and you know, once the husband dies, the in-laws come and say, she was never married to him, and she has no proof. It's such a simple thing in a sense, but That, you know, it's a little thing, and maybe very hard to do, but I think. And then finally, a pension scheme for these women, you know, above a certain age, maybe for the rest of their lives, but at young ages for a couple years, so that they can look after their kids and find a good situation for themselves.
So we see in those examples, you know, how this conversation has relevance to women's legal rights, their financial security, and how those two things intersect. Agnes, how would you add to that in terms of implications for policy?
So in terms of implications for policy, I would say that at the very basic level, I would really like to see men and women have equal rights to property, equal property rights. And I think we're a very long way from reaching there. And one of the things that's often forgotten when we look at property rights is property rights upon marital dissolution. I think that marriage law is as important as inheritance law when you're looking at the devolution of property, because inheritance law governs what happens when somebody dies. But marriage law and what the distribution of assets is upon divorce is upon divorce and also upon death of the spouse is quite important in terms of setting up the woman and her children after the husband dies, because typically it's very typical, because of age differences, that the husband is going to predecease the wife, and she, depending on what the marital regime is, she may be totally unprotected. So I would like to see more a more equitable approach taken to both marriage law and inheritance law.
Well, there you have it. We have a conversation that starts, I think, with a fairly targeted conversation around one specific facet of data collection that we then see has implications for women's equality sort of writ large, their legal rights, their economic empowerment, and more broadly.